Welcome to the AngelPool.org conference call. This is Michael Price. I serve as a 2011 volunteer chair of AngelPool.org, and I'll be moderating the call. We have an excellent speaker today on creating sustainable entrepreneurial communities. First, some housekeeping notes. Everyone is currently in mute. Also, there is no PowerPoint portion of the presentation today. So if any of you did log in to view the presentation, just be aware there is none, so it's not a technical issue. Rather, just be making verbal remarks. After the speaker remarks, I will then provide instructions to unmute your microphone to ask questions. For those joining the call for the first time, AngelPool is a nonprofit organization that assists angel groups across North America to grow. For those angel groups that need additional capital to complete a seed round, the AngelPool Syndication Network provides easy monthly access to a large number of other angel groups within their region looking for quality deals. To increase profitability, each angel group in the AngelPool Syndication Network is also able to view and participate in the other syndicated deals across their entire region to ensure enough high-quality deal flow to their members. It also provides knowledge and educational events like this one today to help angels in their mission of helping entrepreneurs to be more successful so their portfolios in turn will also be successful. With that, let's go ahead and begin. Today's speaker is Brad Feld. He is the Managing Director of the Foundry Group, a $225 million early-stage venture fund focused on startups across North America. The focus is on seed and A rounds, putting in $250,000 or more per investment. Brad has been an early-stage investor and entrepreneur for over 20 years. Prior to co-founding Foundry Group, he co-founded Mobius Venture Capital, and prior to that, founded Intensity Ventures. He was recently ranked the number one most respected venture capitalist in North America from a composite score of The Funded, Social Plus, and Sentiment above John Doerr, Ben Horowitz, Mark Andreessen, and many other top-ranked VCs. Brad has been very generous of his time to build up the entrepreneurial community. Examples include co-founding of Techstars, the number one startup accelerator in the world with locations in Boston, Boulder, Seattle, and New York City. Brad graduated from MIT and serves on the board of many companies to include Zynga. Brad is a nationally recognized speaker on the topics of venture capital, investing, and entrepreneurship, and writes widely with a very well-respected blogs at feld.com, F-E-L-D.com, and askthevc.com. With that, let's go ahead and turn it on over to Brad. Brad, thank you for agreeing to speak to our group.
My pleasure, and thanks for the nice intro. I need to make sure my mom hears a recording of that for future posterity. So we've got about a little bit less than an hour. I'm going to talk for about a half an hour, and then we'll do Q&A for the balance. So I'm happy to address questions that are interesting to you guys. Like I said, a few moments just giving you background so that there's context. I'll spend a little time on the history of Techstars. And then I'll spend the balance of time talking about dynamics in and around entrepreneurial communities and some of the lessons that we've learned both from Techstars as well as other experiences at Foundry Group. Just a thing which I'll try to remember to repeat at the end. If anybody wants to contact me, my email address is simply brad@feld.com. Foundrygroup.com is our website, Feld.com is my blog, and Techstars.org is the Techstars website. So I've been a venture capitalist for 15 years. Prior to that, I started my own company, which is a self-funded business. We raised $10 and ultimately sold it to a public company in 1993. I made about 75 angel investments during two periods of time, 1994 to 96, and then 2006-2007, between the time that Mobius had finished investing in new companies and Foundry had raised their first fund. The current fund that I'm part of, I'm one of four partners. We're based in Boulder, Colorado, but we invest all around the U.S. We're only software internet investors. We do not have to be the first investor in a company, but we typically don't invest after a couple of $1 million have been invested in a company. So our entry point is seed, $250,000, $500,000, Series A, up to, say, $5 million in a Series A, or sometimes a Series B after either angels or other seed investors have done up to $2 to $3 million in a company. The most we'd invest in a first round of a company is probably $10 million, and the most we typically invest in any company over the life of the company is probably $15 million. We're syndication agnostic, which means we're delighted to invest by ourselves. We're also equally delighted to invest with co-investors, both angels and VCs. We do believe that it's up to us to make decisions about each future round of financing. So we'll often do two or three rounds by ourselves. We don't need a new co-investor to come in and lead and price subsequent rounds. We've historically tried to be extremely angel and seed investor friendly. So we're respectful of the seed round terms and the angel round terms. We're even willing, in many cases, when we fund things ourselves, if the company's making progress, to mark up our own investment on ourselves. So we've got a pretty strong philosophy about how we approach things that's come from many, many, many investments, some good, some not good. We currently have about 35 investments in our portfolio. We raised the 2007 fund, which was $225 million, and we just raised another fund in the fall of 2010. Which is also $225 million. We don't have any other people in the firm other than our assistants and our back office. So four partners, but no associates, no principals. We do all the work. In terms of Techstars and just brief history of that, in 2006, I was approached on what I call random day. I would say about once every month, I have a meeting with anybody that wants to get together with me. I have a wiki up, and anybody can schedule 15-minute slots. I do this just to sort of capture all those meetings and be available locally to anybody that wants to get together with me without having that sort of be part of my normal tempo. David Cohen, who's the CEO and the founder of Techstars, came to one of those meetings. David had been a successful entrepreneur, had bootstrapped a company with a partner of his, David Brown, called Pinpoint. They sold it in 2001 or 2002 to a big public company called Zoll. David had left in 2005. He had made some angel investments, $25,000-$50,000 type investments. He was not enjoying it very much. He found the process of making angel investments by himself to be lonely. He also found that he wasn't getting much engagement from the entrepreneurs where he was making the investments. He was also exposed to a handful of angel groups in and around Boulder at the time. They tended to not be very active in actually making investments. They were active in having meetings and having angels through, but they weren't really pulling the trigger on much. So he kind of looked at it and was dissatisfied with how he was interacting with the seed investing phenomena. Came up with an idea for Techstars, both as a way for him to help start a bunch more companies and invest in those companies, but also as a way to bring together some of the active entrepreneurs in the Boulder area. When we got together on that random day, he described his view for what Techstars would be. 5 or 10 minutes into the discussion, I told him I was in, and let's go make it happen. I thought it was a brilliant idea. And the first year of Techstars, which ran in 2007 in Boulder, was funded by David, his partner in his first company, David Brown, myself and Jared Polis, who is also a very successful entrepreneur in Boulder, who's a good friend of mine. So the four of us essentially provided the capital for Techstars itself. I don't remember the exact number of the first year, but it was, $350,000. We invested in each of the companies in the program. So Techstars is a 90-day mentor-driven program. Each company gets two founders get $12,000, three founders get $18,000, three or more founders get $18,000. Techstars takes 6% of the company in common stock, so Techstars, the program, looks like a co-founder. No special rights, no future investment rights, so Techstars gets diluted along with the co-founders of the company. So really their decision is it worth 6% of the company for a little bit of capital so that, we can cover our 3 months of existence while we're in the program, plus the value of the program. We then developed a very clear view on mentor dynamic and got about 50 mentors, two-thirds of them local, a third of them national, almost all entrepreneurs. If you go to techstars.org/mentors, you can see the types of people we're talking about. And our goal was to get actively engaged mentors with these typically first-time, but not exclusively first-time entrepreneurs. The entrepreneurs also, we initially thought that they would skew younger turns out the median age is 29 of all the people that have gone through the program. We open source the results, so if you go to techstars.org/results, you can see the actual results of the first couple of years of the program. And we usually wait about a year before we put the results up from the previous year, just so the companies can either get funded or not get funded and, you know, sort of get to the next level of their evolution. And we did that program in Boulder in 2007. We did another program in 2008 in Boulder, funded by the same four of us. We started getting pulled to other communities. By 2008, lots of people had heard about TechStars, and we probably got somewhere between 50 and 100 inbound requests to TechStars in other cities. One of the investors in a TechStars Boulder company called EventView was a guy named Bill Warner, who's a very successful Boston-based entrepreneur, had done founded a company called Avid in the 1980s, and then also founded a company called Wildfire in the 1990s, both very successful outcomes. Bill was doing angel investing, loved the idea of TechStars, came out to Boulder, spent a day with us, and basically said, I want to sponsor us doing this in Boston. So we decided to do a Boston program just to experiment with expanding geographically to understand what it was. I had spent 12 years in Boston, so I felt very comfortable with Boston. And having sort of a good understanding of the tempo of the community, the angel network, angel community in Boston, as well as the venture community, and the entrepreneurial community at Dynamic. The investor group in Boston was slightly different. So my partners and I, Foundry Group, this time invested in the Boulder program. The partners at Spark Capital invested. Colin Engel, the CEO of iRobot, invested. Arana Gozzi, a co-founder of Harmonix, invested. Will Herman, who is a well-known angel investor, invested. Bill obviously invested. David Cohen invested. So our goal was to try to make the investor group a local investor group rather than one that was controlled by Foundry Group. Boston program is now about to start its third year. We've had 2 years in Boston, very, very satisfied with both the performance of the program and the impact TechStars has had on the Boston software internet entrepreneurial scene. A year ago, the program got pulled to Seattle by an entrepreneur, Andy Sack, and VC Greg Gottesman at a firm called Madrona, both who knew us very well and were big fans of TechStars and had been involved as mentors. In Seattle, we consciously decided to try to get all of the active VC firms as well as many of the active angel investors as part of the fund. So there's about 15 investors in the TechStars Seattle program, many angels that are local and leaders in the local market, as well as the VCs. We then decided to do a fourth program in New York City, which is going on right now. New York actually has 25 investors, so same strategy, lots of local VCs and lots of local angels all actively engaged in funding the program. Each city has about 50 mentors, although New York has about 75 mentors. A little bit of mentor overlap, but most of the mentors are unique to each program. And I'm going to footnote that. I want to talk about the mentorship dynamic and the importance of that effect. And then finally, last week we announced the TechStars Network as part of the Startup America initiative at the White House. We're one of the members of the private side of the partnership, the Startup America partnership. And with TechStars Network, we have 16 different accelerators across the country that are now TechStars Network members. So we're pooling resources across all of these organizations in terms of mentors, access for the entrepreneurs, as well as access for investors. We've tried to open source the TechStars program itself, so the best practices that we've developed and things that we learn, other people that want to start accelerators in other cities across the U.S., can build off of what we've learned. We have a very strong premise that there's at least 100 cities in the U.S. that can comfortably support accelerators as the core of their entrepreneurial ecosystem, not as the core, as a core component of their entrepreneurial ecosystem. There's lots of things that are required, and this is just one of those things that can be additive. A couple of other quick footnotes before I dive right into entrepreneurial community dynamics. David and I last year wrote a book called Do More Faster that Wiley published, which is about 80 different chapters organized in seven themes that are first-person accounts of the entrepreneurial experience. We wrote about 20% of it. Mentors and entrepreneurs who went through Techstars wrote about the other 80% of it, although we organized and knitted the whole thing together in a cohesive narrative. The idea being that there are very few books that are first-person accounts of the startup experience across a wide range of viewpoints. Most of them are either ego books written by a successful entrepreneur that have some utility, but tend to be from one frame of reference, or they're consultant books written by somebody who's not really an entrepreneur but is trying to tell people how, if they just follow these steps, to be an entrepreneur. We tried to get the sort of blend of those pieces in this book and continue to use it to help people understand this early stage entrepreneurial phenomenon. You step back from all that and think about, okay, so that's nice. Congratulations on all of those things that you've done. How does that apply to an entrepreneurial community building activity in City X, where City X is one of the 95 cities of the country that Techstars is not in? One of the things that I have come to believe is that the mentor dynamic within an entrepreneurial community is key to the sustainability. Essentially, there's a handful of characteristics an entrepreneurial community needs to have to sustain itself over a long period of time. The challenge of most entrepreneurial communities is that they tend to be temporal. You have 2 or 3 or 4 years of excitement and activity. We're obviously in one of those phases now where the word entrepreneurship is on everybody's lips, and the idea of startups are front and center, an exciting part of what's going on again. But in many parts around the country, there's cynicism because they've seen this before. You saw this before the internet bubble. You might have seen this earlier in the 1980s or 1990s at some point. A lot of people even saw this sort of post-internet bubble, sort of prior to the economic crisis in 2005, 2006, maybe even 2007, where there's some activity again. So you have these situations where pockets of entrepreneurial activity pop up. And by the way, they're not just software internet. They can be in any category. Bio, clean tech, retail. Boulder, just for example, is the home of the natural foods industry, so there's a huge natural foods entrepreneurial community in and around the city of Boulder. But when something happens, people move away, there's a macro downturn, and everybody feels poor, and so the angel activity dries up, venture capital industry goes through a dislocation, and there's issues there. The anchor company in the community gets bought by some other big company and everything gets shuffled around. But something happens that causes there to be a real slowdown or, frankly, in a lot of cases, disappearance of that entrepreneurial energy. What I've concluded is you need the following couple of characteristics to sustain the entrepreneurial community over a period of time. The first and probably most important is a very long-term view. And very long-term for me is 20 years from today. So it's not 20 years from 15 years ago, but a view that from this point forward, the leaders of the entrepreneurial community, whoever they are, need to be leading with a perspective of a 20-year view. The number of leaders in the entrepreneurial community don't have to be hundreds. In fact, 5 to 10 or 5 to 15 people is probably plenty. But those have to be people that are committed to investing time and energy in helping build, develop, and expand the entrepreneurial community over that period of time. It should be entrepreneurship and entrepreneur-led. So 100% of the leaders don't have to be entrepreneurs, but if 0% of the leaders are entrepreneurs, you've got a problem. It can't be the service providers, the lawyers and the accountants. It can't be the investors, the angels, and the VCs. It has to be entrepreneurs at the core of leading that entrepreneurial community. There have to be activities that allow the entire entrepreneurial community to engage over a period of time. So I'm sure all of you have been to your share of awards events, Chamber of Commerce Entrepreneur of the Year, or annual VC forum event, or annual angel forum event, or even monthly angel investor events. Those things are all fine, but they don't really engage people in an active way around the creation of the company. And interestingly, Techstars ended up being one of those very tangible things where over 90 days, the entrepreneurial community could rally around the creation of something. Interestingly, it has to be, I'll use the word temporal, it cannot be a continuous thing. If Techstars ran in Boulder all year long, it would burn people out. And so the idea that it's 90 days long, people can engage for 90 days and go really deep, and then there's 9 months of other stuff going on, but the next wave of this intense program doesn't start again for 9 months, and then only lasts for 90 days, gives people a way to engage very actively and deeply for a period of time that's manageable. It has to be something that runs up and down the entire spectrum of the entrepreneurial community. One of the challenges I've seen, especially as I wander around the country, is I see a lot of entrepreneurial community cliques. You have, the people that hang together, sort of like in high school, how the people that hung together, and the groups don't overlap enough. They overlap occasionally, but they don't work together on stuff. And having activities that cause first-time entrepreneurs, people that are running their first company and sort of actively in a business, serial multi-time entrepreneurs, entrepreneurs who are on the bench thinking about what the next thing to do is, angel investors who used to be entrepreneurs, angel investors who weren't entrepreneurs but come with money either from whatever careers they had or other resources or investments that they've made, venture capital investors participating in that chain, retired, experienced members of the community that are interested in entrepreneurship and interested in the long-term health of the community. All of those categories of people and more need to have specific, tangible things to do together other than show up at an event, have drinks and talk. And TechStars has really served that role in a very meaningful way. There's a lot of second-order effects that come out of that, including lots of new relationships amongst the mentors, the investors, et cetera, people that haven't worked together in 5 or 10 years that get re-engaged, and in some very entertaining cases, people who actually didn't like each other but didn't know why they didn't like each other, and when they actually ended up having something to do together, found out that they liked each other a lot. So those are some very key characteristics associated with building an entrepreneurial community that's sustainable. One is a very long-term view. One is leaders that share that long-term view that are entrepreneur-led, activities that engage everybody up and down the spectrum. And then it leads to the last, which is continually getting new entrepreneurs into the community and having a way for them to easily become part of the community and do work in that community. And those new entrepreneurs often are younger people that are, coming out of school or that are relocating from somewhere else or coming back home from where they grew up because they want to be back there after they've gone away. But it's not exclusively limited to that. It's also people in the community who have been there for a while, who have been working somewhere that now want to be entrepreneurs, other people that move from another geography that have been entrepreneurs and have been successful, but for whatever reason decide to relocate themselves and their family. It's remarkable how difficult it is in many communities across the U.S. for those types of people to find and get connected into their entrepreneurial community. And figuring out ways in each of your communities to make that easy continues to bring fresh blood in on a regular basis. It's very powerful. One of the things that I think is a very interesting phenomenon is the idea that if you take a long-term view and you're not playing a year-to-year game, you have the potential to develop a reputation and a style around your entrepreneurial community that's unique. I lived in Boston for many years. I moved to Boulder. I invest a lot in Silicon Valley and spend a lot of time in Silicon Valley. And people go through waves where all of a sudden everybody wants to be the next Silicon Valley, and it manifests itself in some entertaining ways, like people defining their communities as Silicon X, Silicon Alley, Silicon Beach, Silicon Mountain, whatever. Or, government leaders pounding the table and saying, we're going to create the next Silicon Valley here. That, in my mind, is a stupid approach. And it's a stupid approach because Silicon Valley is an amazing place and a unique place that has been under development for, 60-plus years now. And instead of trying to become the next Silicon Valley, there are a lot of things about Silicon Valley that are very powerful, and abstracting those lessons out, some of which are the ones that I talk about here, can be the essence of community building. Others are things that are worth emulating, and then there are plenty of things that are worth avoiding. And being very conscious that in your community you're behaving differently. And I'll give a tangible example. In Boulder, there tends to be much more openness between entrepreneurs about ideas and sharing of ideas, and much less fluidity of people across companies. So people tend to be pretty sticky to the companies they work for as long as those companies are operating and growing and in business. But they're very open and collaborative with their peers about ideas. In the Bay Area, there's a different type of openness, and in many cases, lack of openness because of competitive dynamics between companies doing similar things. But there's incredible permeability of people as they move around from company to company. Now, neither is good or bad. I'm not making a judgment on them, but they're different. And the things that you do in terms of nurturing and growing the entrepreneurial community over time should be reactive to those differences. Last thought I want to give before we do Q&A is I have been actively investing across the country now, first as an angel investor and then as a venture capital investor since 1994. And what I find absolutely fascinating and intriguing is the cultural differences in communities about what's going on in the entrepreneurial scene. And those cultural differences tend to manifest themselves as boundaries between different constituencies, the angels, the VCs, the entrepreneurs, the first-time entrepreneurs, the kids coming out of college that want to start a company. And if you plop me down in any city in the country, within a couple of days, it's pretty clear sort of what the barriers to progress of an evolution of the entrepreneurial community are, not because of any brilliant insights that I have, but because people will just talk openly about it. And I find that one of the things that happens is if people are talking openly in their entrepreneurial community about what the barriers are, what the gates are, what's blocking them from making progress. And there are leaders who are emergent, not anointed, but emergent, who say, I'm going to break down those barriers, and I'm going to try to make sure we move things forward. And those leaders are really committed to doing it for a period of time that's longer than the next year or two. Some remarkable things happen. And I've seen that in some big cities. And I've seen that in some small cities, and Boulder is important to recognize. You know, we're only 100,000 people in Boulder itself, a quarter of a million people in sort of the greater Boulder metro. And, you know, we're 30 minutes away from a 2-million-person city in Denver. But the entrepreneurial concentration in Boulder is so high, sort of on a per capita basis, that as a result, because there's people focused on lowering barriers, yeah, there's plenty of things that don't work. There's plenty of breakage in the system. There's definitely people who get frustrated or feel alienated. But the bulk of the momentum of the entrepreneurial community growth is sort of picks up speed in a way that is more rather than less inclusive. If I had a thing to sort of leave everybody with in a generic sense, it's wherever you are, be a leader. Focus on other leaders and rallying other leaders that do not necessarily look or act like you, so get a diverse portfolio, take a long-term view around it, and together try to figure out what's holding back the entrepreneurial community, and rather than, you know, either fight against it or complain about it or be frustrated by it or be blocked by it, actively try to figure out how to co-opt it into being part of the growth and evolution of what you're doing. So with that, why don't we shift to Q&A, and Michael, you tell me how you want to moderate.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you so much for your comments. For those who would like to ask questions, if you would go ahead and hit *6 on your phone, and then go ahead and ask your question. Again, *6, and then ask your question. Go right ahead. And by the way, Brad, I've got a couple that were texted over to me, so let me go ahead and begin with these. Can you talk a little bit about the Startup America partnership?
Sure. So on a week ago Monday, the White House announced the Startup America program, and as part of that, which is a public-private partnership, also announced the Startup America Partnership, which is the private side of it. Carl Schramm, who is the CEO of the Kauffman Foundation, which I'm sure many of you know as the leading foundation supporting entrepreneurship in America, and Carl is a really impressive, very capable guy. And Steve Case, who is the founder of AOL, are the co-chairmen of the private side of the partnership. The overall goal of Startup America is to provide much more focus, activity, resources, and acceleration for what are being referred to as high-growth entrepreneurs. So if you look at federal government over the last 15 or so years, all entrepreneurial activity has been lumped into this taxonomy called small business. And, you know, the Small Business Administration is the administration for small business, and it doesn't matter whether you own a grocery store or the corner gas station or a local retail store, or you're the CEO of Zynga, which is growing from, 10 people to 2,000 people in 3 years. You're classified as small business in the context of federal government. And a lot of research now, including from Kauffman, which has done some of the seminal research, that shows that the vast majority of net new job growth does not come from small business. It comes from a very small subset of that, which is now being referred to as high-growth entrepreneurs. And high-growth entrepreneurial businesses are ones that are high-growth. And, they have a lot of creative destruction along the way. Plenty of those companies grow and fail. But some of them break out and become, Googles, et cetera. And as part of that dynamic, if you actually look at the economic impact on the U.S. and the overall vector of innovation in the country and the overall economic returns from an investment, that's a segment that has unique characteristics and unique needs separate from small business. The neat thing about Startup America is I think it's the first time, at least since I've been a grown-up, that our federal government is recognizing this distinction and trying to do something about it. I spent the last 9 months involved in this sort of evolution of this program, and I got connected in because I was one of the seven people that have been created and have been advocating the Startup Visa, which is a visa program for foreign entrepreneurs that want to start a company in the U.S. So I got connected to some folks in Office of Science and Technology Policy, OEC, and National Economic Council. And my reaction to them in the context of this program has been extremely positive. These are smart people. They get it. They listen. And they're also very aware that it's not government's role to fund this activity, nor is it government's role to create certain programs that underwrite this activity. That instead, if the federal government understands the distinction and can shine a bright light on it and help organize the private sector around this, there's already an immense amount of activity in the private sector. That's the feedback they've gotten from me and from other people. Hence the public-private partnership, where the public side of the partnership from the White House is a very visible understanding, support, and desire to accelerate entrepreneurial activity across the country. But not a support by writing checks into startups. And then the private side of the partnership right now is the initial launches with 27 different organizations that ranged from large companies that made commitments to fund entrepreneurs and innovative activities to organizations like Techstars who made a commitment to, in our case, our specific commitment is to help 6,000 entrepreneurs work with 5,000 mentors to create 25,000 new jobs by 2015. So very tangible set of goals that, then manifest themselves in different ways. Startup America is very much a startup. I mean, Steve Case was very articulate about it and said, look, this is the launch. We have a lot that we're going to do wrong, and we have a lot that we're going to do right, and we're going to change a lot of things along the way. And so it's pretty cool to have a real entrepreneur you know, who's been involved in building very substantial businesses at the head of this.
Okay, thank you. If anyone would like to ask a live question, again, just hit star six. That should unmute your microphone.
Yeah, Brad. Yes, Brad, this is Bob Summers of 468 in Blacksburg, Virginia. Thank you for sharing the history of TechStars. It's very inspiring for us here. I got one key question for you. What are the key investment criteria that you look for when you're dealing with a first-time entrepreneur? We have a lot of college students here at Virginia Tech that are developing mobile and internet software companies that are kind of pre-revenue. What are the kind of things that you're looking for in your portfolio for those kind of businesses?
Sure. So let me describe it generally versus specifically in the context of Foundry Group. I think what we're mostly focused on generically is significant ideas that are driven by entrepreneurs who are extremely passionate about that specific idea. And the passion is really key in a first-time entrepreneur. You have a lot of people who I run into who you know, are working on a business that it's the only thing they could come up with, or it's a idea that somebody else had that they sort of got roped into, versus it's something that they're obsessed with from their perspective. There's a well-known theory around entrepreneurship that Ed Roberts, an MIT professor who's also a very successful entrepreneur, espoused in the 1980s in a book he wrote, which is the difference between need for independence and need for achievement. And while both types of entrepreneurs that exhibit both characteristics can be successful, entrepreneurs that have a need for achievement have a much higher positive correlation with success, and their successes tend to be much larger. So for that first-time entrepreneur, we're always looking for passion and obsession with the idea they're working on and a very, very strong need for achievement. Just as a footnote, in terms of Foundry Group, we have a set of themes that we invest in, and we define those themes. If you go to foundrygroup.com and search for the word theme, you'll see them there: human-computer interaction, digital life, glue, sort of abstract constructs that are pretty broad, tend to be very horizontal in nature. But we use them as filters so we can say no to 99% of the stuff that we see. And the 1% of the stuff that we see that fits within those themes, we already know those markets extremely well. We know how the businesses evolve. We don't have to worry about market size. We don't have to worry about competitive dynamics. We're all product nerds, so we're pretty obsessed ourselves with the actual technology and technology products. So we can then spend the vast majority of our evaluation time on the entrepreneur and the idea in the context of the entrepreneur.
Okay, thank you for that question. If anyone else has a question, just hit star six to unmute your mic and go right ahead. Brad, we have another one that was texted in talking about how to build a strong mentor base. And I remember that you had mentioned, I think, in passing, maybe in an email, that you've been able to surround the TechStars organization with great mentors. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how to find them, how to know, you know, is any training necessary? You know, how do you make them good, and what do you think their impact is?
So it's actually extraordinarily easy to find mentors and people that want to engage as mentors once you have a vehicle for them to do something with. Once, you know, our year one of TechStars in Boulder, you know, the mentors were all people we were either 1 or 2 degrees of separation from. But by year two, the vast majority of people in the entrepreneurial community that were active wanted to be mentors to the program. So you very quickly generate this phenomenon where people want to engage because of the reputational impact of their ability, you know, the sort of notion that they're doing something tangible. The challenge with most mentors is the dynamics around giving advice and recognizing that it's up to the entrepreneur to synthesize the advice, and in many cases synthesize very conflicting pieces of advice, versus, you know, feeling like the entrepreneur, if they don't follow your advice, somehow they're a lost cause. So a mentor, you know, needs to approach it from the position where they're providing data rather than they're telling the answer. Fly-by mentors are not very useful. So the, you know, famous entrepreneur who comes and gives a talk, hangs out for a little while, disappears and then never responds to emails from the entrepreneurs is not very useful, versus the experienced entrepreneur who comes by, spends some time, and then goes deep with one or two of the entrepreneurs and is very available. Doesn't have to be available for everybody, but very available for a couple that he or she has real affinity for. So we really work hard to coach the mentors to engage, not on day one of the TechStars program, but by day 30 with one, maybe two companies, and to be very explicit about what their commitments are. So, for example, I'm mentoring one of the companies in the New York program. It's an entrepreneur who I like and who's working on something that I feel like I have a lot to add. And, you know, he and I have a standing 30-minute Skype call once a week at the same time, where that goal of that call is anything that's on his mind is what we talk about. And then we have regular email interactions throughout the week on numerous things. So defining that sort of rhythm, and that's a rhythm. It's not the only rhythm. A lot of mentors come in and spend a day with companies. Other mentors, you know, have a totally different approach to it. But defining that rhythm clearly with the entrepreneur is super important. And then the last is recognizing as a mentor that you're dealing with first-time entrepreneurs, and that the understanding and the social dynamics of that first-time entrepreneur around entrepreneurship tend to be weak, naive, and experienced, whatever word you want to use. And, you know, having a steady and firm hand, giving directive advice, that's deep and thoughtful, but also letting that entrepreneur make mistakes, and being support for that entrepreneur when they make mistakes, especially, you know, early in the life of a company, many of the mistakes are people-related. Again, rather than cutting to the chase and saying what you should do is X, trying to be Socratic but not Socratic to a fault where you never get to the punchline. So sort of the balance between those two ends of the spectrum, I think, is really important.
Okay, very good. Any other questions? If you have any questions, just hit star 6 and proceed with your question.
I have a question.
Go right ahead.
Brad, I know that with VCs, they have wide networks of entrepreneurs, and oftentimes at a stage they sort of decide that the founder had a great idea, but they want to bring in someone else to be a CEO. Do you think that kind of action is appropriate at the angel stage, or do you think we kind of have to go with the one who brought the idea in?
I think it varies and is very situation specific. I'd also say the generality is one to be careful of. So, for example, in Foundry Group, we actually don't have that philosophy at all. In fact, I would say out of the 35 companies we've invested, there have only been a couple of companies where there were CEO changes, and they were very deliberate and sort of well thought out. And in many cases, we have entrepreneurs who are first-time entrepreneurs or first-time CEOs who, you know, our intention and belief is that they can scale up indefinitely with the company. So I think, you know, the first is to recognize that it is very situational specific. As an angel investor, whenever, you know, when I look back into the 75 angel investments that I made, I don't think I ever made an angel investment with the intention of not being supportive of the entrepreneurs around the table I was investing. And I viewed it philosophically as, you know, if I didn't support them and didn't believe that they could at least take it to the next level, whatever that was, then I shouldn't be investing. But I don't think that that's an absolute truth. I think there's definitely cases where, especially when you run into a solo entrepreneur, that solo entrepreneur really needs a partner. Or when you get a couple of entrepreneurs, they really need somebody to work with them, and it's incumbent upon the early investors to help them get there. So I guess the thing I would encourage is, as an angel investor, one of the things you can do is really help the entrepreneurs understand what they need, especially if they're first-time entrepreneurs, before you write the check. And being explicit about what you think the entrepreneurs need, and actually not just saying you need this, but if you believe they need another person on the leadership team, or, you know, they need a CEO, that's somebody in your network, actually working constructively to tee it up as an option, recognizing it's always the entrepreneur's choice to say, no, I don't really want to do that. And as the angel investor, you should be perfectly comfortable saying, okay, great, you know, good luck, and this is not something I'm into then.
Great, thanks.
Any other questions from the group? I think there was one final one that was texted in to me, Brad. I'm just going to try to read this. A lot of our time is spent saying no to entrepreneurs and not funding them. Any advice as to how we can provide value to them instead of a no?
Yeah, it wears on you. I was every day. Throughout the day, I write somewhere between 5 and 25 emails to people saying thanks for reaching out to me, but this isn't something that we'd be interested in, and. I often try to give them something useful, but if I tried to give everybody something useful, I'd never actually get anything done. So it does wear on you because you want to be helpful to everybody. I think the thing that I've tried to do over time is be accessible to entrepreneurs, even if I am not going to be an investor in their company, but not try to solve for their problems. So if I can make connections, give advice, give feedback on something that I feel like I have any special competence or experience on, I will. And if I don't, I'm quick to say I don't really feel like I have a clue there. I think especially in an entrepreneurial community, where you're making angel investments and you're part of that community, just being available, being open with your network with people that you think are credible. So you sort of separate the world into three categories of people that you're going to be approached by. Category one is the people you want to fund unambiguously. You're going to be investors in and working with them. Category three is people that you just don't want to work with for whatever reason. Unambiguously, you don't like them. You don't like what they're doing. There's some history that causes you not to have respect or interest in them. And then category two is everybody else in the middle where you have no idea where it might go. You don't want to invest in what they're working on now for whatever reason, but you like them, you respect them, you'd like to see them make some progress. I really encourage anybody that cares about long-term entrepreneurial community building to just be available to those folks and help them, but recognize that there should be boundaries on how much time you spend with them and make sure that you're providing them with things that are high impact.
Very good. Any final questions from the group?
This is Bill Houston in Chicago.
Bill, go right ahead.
I wonder, Brad, what is the logic behind having so many companies in your portfolio? Is that the best way to invest, and how do you think about that?
Well, so let me be discreet about it. In Foundry Group, our expectation, we have about 35 investments that are active across these two funds. Our expectation for Foundry Group is every fund we raise, which we plan to raise every 3 or 4 years, exactly the same size. So we've got a strategy of never raising more than $225 million. Each fund will have about 30 investments plus or minus in it. And our general sense is that for the four of us, we can handle that kind of portfolio size, especially given the related themes, and that the amount of money that we're putting in the companies that we're investing in sort of matches up with that kind of volume. Let me separate that from my behavior as an angel investor, where I was investing in about a company a month, maybe even two companies a month as an active angel investor. My strategy, and I wrote a blog post about it a while back on Feld.com, which if you search for, angel, or if you type angel space 75, you'll probably find it because those were two keywords I know were in it. I had a belief and a strategy where I invested the same amount of money in every company with the idea that I held in reserves that amount again. So every investment I made, if I made a $50,000, I started off at $25,000 was my check size with the idea that I would double down and write another $25,000 check. Over time, that became a $50,000 base check size with a $50,000 second check. And I made a few exceptions. Every now and then I'd invest, $100,000 or $200,000 in something for very specific reasons. my view was, as an angel investor, I was always a small investor. You know, I would end up owning a less than a percent to maybe 2% of the company, depending on, you know, the total capital raised and pricing and dilution in the future. And I was playing as an angel investor for 100x. And I ended up having two investments that generated more than 100x each. And when I reflect back on the strategy, which I had and was deliberate, my view was I was gonna pick a number of companies that ended up being decent returns, 2x, 3x, 5x. I had, you know, some 10x's and some mid-20s and that sort of thing. But I was going to have an awful lot of zeros. And I was going to have zeros either because companies got recapitalized and as an angel investor, you know, my ownership stake got washed out because I wasn't going to continue to play, or the companies just failed. And I really believed that having a larger volume of companies that I was an investor in an area, everything was related to software internet, so I sort of stayed within a domain I was comfortable with, but across a wider base, gave me a much higher chance of identifying those that would generate 100x. And, you know, if you think about it, I got 2 out of 75 that had that outcome, and then, you know, probably out of the 75, I had another, you know, 10, you know, that generated 10x or more. That's where the returns came from. If I had done one investment a year and ended up with five investments, the chance of me landing on, you know, those companies was much, much less.
Can I follow up the ones that were 10Xs or 100Xs? Did you have a sneaking suspicion that those were winners from the beginning?
Absolutely not. So one of the 100Xs was a company called Harmonix, which was two guys, one who was a fraternity brother, and they were, this comes back to sort of what caused me to invest. They were both incredibly smart. They were obsessed with music. They were both musicians, and they loved video games. And they believed that they could create a company that would change the way that people, you know, video games and music intersected. And from, I invested in 1994, and from 1994 to 2002, they barely stayed alive. There's a great Inc. magazine article about the story of Harmonix if you go to Inc.com and search for Harmonix. I mean, they literally, you know, month after month, they barely make payroll. They barely stay alive. They never raised that much money. They only raised, they didn't ever raise venture money. They got enough business. They sort of hung in there because they wrote some video games, and, you know, they make enough money to sort of survive another year. And it wasn't until Guitar Hero, they created Guitar Hero, that the company really took off. And even after they shipped Guitar Hero, they'd had 10... you know, previous video games that they'd launched that sort of did okay but never really hit it. And so even when they shipped Guitar Hero, they had no expectations that that was going to be a home run. In that company, just how far from knowing that was going to be a success it was, when they got acquired and the documents got circulated, and it was literally like 12 years from the point of the investment, the round that I was in, which was a $500,000 round, which was they did $100,000 friends and family round, you know, just with their parents and stuff, and then $500,000 from me, a couple of my friends, my dad, the two guys that bought my first company. Nobody remembered anything about the company. Not nobody. Most people didn't remember anything about the company, and a number of people, when they got the deal docs, you know, they sent me emails saying, should I sign these? I assume that this is worthless. Because they'd long ago sort of written off the idea that it would be worth anything. And when they got checks that were for, you know, 50 to 100 times their investment, they were absolutely blown away.
All right, very good. I think that we're almost out of time. Brad, thank you so much for taking an hour to share your thoughts with so many angels across North America today. Your involvement and dedication to entrepreneurism sets a high benchmark for others to follow. Thank you.
Thanks. And as I said earlier, my email is brad@feld.com. I try to respond to everything, so if there's something that got missed or a follow-up or something to connect on, just drop me a note.
Perfect. Thank you so much. For all the angel groups that are able to join us across North America, we appreciate your participating. Hopefully this angel knowledge series will be useful in your efforts. The next date for the knowledge series is going to be on March 10th. That'll be Martin Varsovsky, the founder of Afan, with mobile and telecom strategies. If you wish to see the additional speakers coming up, you can go to angelpool.org. Again, angelpool.org, and there you'll see that we've got a number of top super angels and others that will be speaking, to include Jeff Clavier of SoftTech, Josh Koppelman of First Round, Reid Hoffman, currently of Greylock Partners and the founder of LinkedIn, Chris Dixon of Founders Collective, and a number of other leaders. The call is now concluded. Thanks all, and have a great day.
You're about to end this meeting. To end, press 1. To return, you're the only person still in the meeting. You can hang up.